It's your boy.
All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome, welcome one and all to episode 62 of the SLS Cast. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we're at the chloroform episode. I know. Chloroform? Like, what kind of creepy shit are we going to do with chloroform? We're not going to do anything creepy, we promise. And if we did, we chloroformed you and you wouldn't know about it anyway. And the reason why I say that is because the boiling point of chloroform just happens to be 62 degrees Celsius. With that disturbing bit of information, I am your host, Matt.
And I am Tim. How's it going?
Oh, it's going well. It's going well, except for the fact that I'm completely burnt out on movies and school.
Yeah, you've been watching a lot of them. You went back and rewatched a lot of things that you didn't get a chance to go see the past few weeks.
Holy crap, I did. I went absolutely insane. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I went out of my way to make sure that I got completely caught up on every single stupid thing that I missed. Literally from The Secret Life of Walter Mitty to everything that I screwed up on the whole show that I screwed up. So there's reviews now for... Now these are just review quick like things. Just go to the site. Go to slscast.com and you'll be able to see them there. I'm not going to waste any time with what I thought of them and all that kind of stuff. I just made sure to get in there and actually watch them and rate them. So now that you have official ratings for everything that we should have seen, including SLS cast ratings now. But I mean, yeah, I made up for Jack Ryan, Inside Llewellyn Davis, Francis Ha. Also made sure to go back and catch Dirty Wars, 20 Feet from Stardom to get that.
Which for any of you guys that had some kind of like pot going, he in fact did not like Dirty Wars. We all expected Matt to not like it.
Hey, I gave it more credit than I gave Elysium. Does that count for anything? Does that count at all for anything?
It does. Yeah, it actually says a little bit, in fact.
You know why? Because this was at least someone being honest about what they were doing. I hated what they were doing. It was just a complete smear job as far as I'm concerned. But I still respect the fact that they came out swinging. And they came out swinging for what they believed in. So fine, whatever. So at least I gave them a half star for that. It's the only half of anything that they got from me. But yeah. But at least now I'm all caught up, so I only have to watch whatever movies we're supposed to watch this week.
Yes. Which is still a lot.
Yeah.
It's a number. That's cool. But hey, I have a bit of news that I got from Yahoo News. It was for last week's show. But we didn't get around to doing it since we got caught up talking about Disneyland. This is something that, for some reason, I thought you would enjoy this. And maybe even you guys, too, that are listening to the show. That one listener. Okay, so a British man, obviously in the UK, in the London area, he requested to have his passport changed. Because he recently changed his name, like somehow legally changed his name to something quite ridiculous. He is quoted as being the most tattooed man in Britain. He spent $40,000 covering 90% of his body with tattoos. That is how heavily tattooed this guy is, literally. So you can just have that kind of visual going on in your head. So he's tattooed, pierced. Apparently he's a super cool guy, super nice guy. However, he was formerly known as Matthew Leland, but in 2009, this Matthew Leland changed his name to... All right, here it goes. This is ridiculous. I don't know. He probably has tripped on so much acid that he is forever in a state of tripping balls, because this is just ridiculous. His name is, as since 2009, King of Inkland, King Body Art, the Extreme Inkite. And that is why the British government has denied his request for a passport change. Because his name is King of Inkland, King Body Art, the Extreme Inkite. And here I thought a weird conversation would have been when Sting, I forget what his original name was, but whenever he went up to his friends or his parents and said, guys, I don't want you to. I want you to quit calling me my real name. And I, from here on out, I want to be known as Sting. I just want to see this guy's interaction with his parents. Guys, you know, I don't want you to call me Matthew Leland anymore. I want you to call me King of Inkland, King Body Art of the Extreme Inkite. So, yes, that is the news that I've been wanting to share with you for the past week or two. Super exciting.
That is definitely some ridiculously exciting news. However, I have something that I think is going to be even more exciting than that.
Really?
Yes. Yes, yes. As we all know, the pariah of the United States as of last year was a young man by the name of George Zimmerman. And because of his unique status in the world today, there is a guy out there who thinks that it's a good idea to promote boxing matches with infamous people. And this is the deal. DMX is to fight George Zimmerman in a boxing match that is supposedly happening on March 1st. This is from Pitchfork.com, courtesy of Carrie Baton. And while TMZ reports that DMX is still a negotiating contract, the fight isn't 100% official, but it is real. The DMX does want to fight George Zimmerman. This is a guy by the name of Damon Feldman who puts these things together. This is a guy who put Tonya Harding together with a waitress. And this is what DMX had to say about it. He says, quote, "I would not be boxing for me. I'd be boxing for the legacy of Trayvon Martin and his family. He's going to be fighting on behalf of, quote, every black person who has been done wrong in the system. I'm going to beat the living fuck out of him. I am breaking every rule in boxing to make sure I fuck him up right." End quote. He also threatened to piss on Zimmerman's face. I just thought that was kind of like holy shit crazy. I don't understand why George Zimmerman would say yes to this.
Will guns be allowed in the event?
I have no idea. I imagine at the point that people start pissing on his face, he might go for one. That's the crazy shit that I found. Just wanted to share that with you. Thought that was exciting.
Huh. It's interesting. However, I still prefer the U-Bowl, the director, the horrible, 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 horrible director.
Oh, yeah.
When he challenged all of his critics in a boxing match, and just one by one, he just beat the living shit out of each and every one of them.
That was really cool, though. I mean, because even those people, when they, like, I remember watching when they came out.
Yeah, the little nerdy
guys.
They
had respect for him. At least they had respect for him for, like, hey, man, he's willing to beat the shit out of me over it. I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, but man. That's why he's able to make shitty movies. So many shitty movies. It's because everybody's scared of him.
That's probably how he gets the budgets. Did you see what I did to those motherfuckers in the ring? Here, have some money, I'm sorry.
It's the same thing with DMX. That's why DMX has a career, because everybody's frightened of him.
He walks up, come on. It's your boy, Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, so how about we just go ahead and get right to the news? What do you say?
Sounds like a plan.
All right, folks, here we go. Here we go. Here we go. The news!
Matt, you're drunk. Quit while you're ahead.
Okay, goodbye. Go home. You're drunk. All right, first up from TheGuardian.com, courtesy of Mark Sweeney, Netflix to spend $3 billion on TV and film content in 2014. The on-demand streaming site ended 2013 with net profits of $112 million. And that's despite all the costs of the rights and the commissioning and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you got to think how big they are and how much money they spend, and they still cleared net money, net, after paying everybody, after paying the bonuses, after paying out the people and the rights and the movie, they still cleared $112 million. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. At any rate, they are going to spend $3 billion more on TV and film content in 2014. And over the next 3 years, it's going to be more than $6 billion. I think that is just totally cool. I hope, though, with the advent of the ruling that ended net neutrality, that maybe they might switch gears a little bit and instead spend some of that $3 billion creating new infrastructure and then go and create their own ISP and just completely shut everybody the fuck down. Well, except for, like, Google. I mean, you know, I think that would just be outstanding if Netflix did that. I'm not joking. I would buy them. I mean, you know, hey, remember, Blockbuster laughed in their face once when Netflix said, hey, we should partner up. And Blockbuster laughed in their face. And now what's up? We got Deadline.com, courtesy of the Deadline team. James Franco's production company acquires a book about so bad it's good cult movie, The Room. The Disaster Artist is the book. My Life Inside the Room. Yes, James Franco has acquired it. Well, his production company has acquired it. I think it'll be really, really cool to see what they can do with this if they actually just go, you know, just try and go from the book and do it, or if they're just going to do the typical Hollywood thing where it's based on and then they just go and create their own thing. I think that given what James Franco's capable of with the comedy chops that he's got, not to mention the access to the amazingly funny people that he has, along with the fact that he actually can do some acting, lends the idea that I kind of hope they actually do run the gamut of the just based on, so that this way they can completely redo The Room and really see what would happen when you could get some just absolutely insane stuff. Break the fourth wall and just have a whole lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I really want to read that book. And you still haven't seen The Room.
No, not all the way. I've seen bits and pieces of it. I have never actually gone to sit down to a full screening of The Room.
Oh, man, that needs to happen.
Yes, and I want to. No, this is not a matter of not wanting to. This is just never actually had the opportunity to do so. But, I mean, I have seen actual scenes and bits and pieces. I actually know what the movie is about. I get why it's so funny. You know, you're tearing me apart, Lisa! No, I get it. I mean, yeah. It's not like I'm in the dark. All right, next up for me, Collider.com, courtesy of Dave Trumbore. Will Smith turns down Independence Day sequel. That's right, folks. It is no longer up in the air. It's no longer wondering which way the wind is going to blow. Even though Roland Emmerich did have two scripts, one with Will Smith's character in it and one without, Will Smith has now officially said, I'm out. I'm out. The game is over, okay? And they are going to go on with the script that does not have Will Smith in it.
And it's supposed to be like a trilogy, I believe. It's supposed to spawn a trilogy, or a new trilogy, or two more sequels.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't quite tell if it's been a little unclear, because I thought it was going to be a trilogy starting now, but then I thought it was going to be a trilogy including the first one. So that this would be like the middle.
Oh, yeah.
And then
maybe that's what I meant.
A third. I don't know. It really just, yeah. We'll have to see. The movie's still in development hell.
Yeah, but I mean, even like, I guess it could happen without Will Smith. I'm just thinking about the first movie that part of the reason why the movie worked so well was because of Will Smith, and everybody wasn't quite sick and tired of him by that time.
Well, true, but Roland Emmerich has proved time and time again that he does not need Will Smith to blow up the Eastern Seaboard.
That's right.
Specifically the White House. We already know that he can do it without Will Smith, so let's just see what he can do now. I'm willing to give him a chance, see what he can do. We already know he can blow up everything anyway.
Lost World Jurassic Park, where this is going to be another sequel where Jeff Goldblum takes over as the lead. If it is
the case,
he is going to be
that. For me, that would not necessarily be a bad thing.
Oh, I don't think so either. I enjoyed Lost World as a kid, for whatever it's worth.
Well, Lost World was okay. Jeff Goldblum did a good job of holding his own. I'm not saying that he didn't, but, I don't know. I would like to see it, but I'm not sure exactly where it would go in that regard. At any rate, next up, CinemaBlend.com, Idina Menzel will perform Frozen's Let It Go at the Oscars. She tweeted back on the 11th of February, "It's really happening. I'm singing on the Oscars. Surreal. Thank you, Frozen family and Oscar producers, for this incredible opportunity." I, for one, really want to catch this performance, mainly because I've seen her do some stuff live on TV and YouTube and the internets and the interwebs and what have you. And she's an amazing singer. She can clearly outsing me any day of the week and twice on Sundays. Not taking anything away from her. She's had a Broadway career before she became famous on screen.
Yeah, Rent and Wicked.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Two big shows. But I have definitely seen some hit and miss come out of her live. And I really want to see how well she does. Because I want to see if this one's going to be a hit or a miss. Well, you know, so whatever.
Yeah. Did you also see that U2 is going to be performing as well? For their Mandela Long Walk to Freedom song,
yes,
or whatever it's called.
Yes, I know. I'm kind of thinking that it's pretty much between those two songs in terms of who's going to win. I mean, I'm sorry, everybody else who got nominated and anyone else who was nominated and subsequently had their nomination taken away. Not that I'm naming names or pointing fingers or elbows or anything. But I mean, I am pretty damn sure that it is up between you two and Idina Menzel. Well, I guess whoever. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with who wrote Let It Go. However, the dude who did write Let It Go, if he gets it, he's going to get an EGOT.
An EGOT?
Yes.
What's an EGOT?
It will complete an EGOT. He will, because he's written, he's a songwriter, and he's written an Emmy-winning song, a Tony-winning song, and he's gotten a Grammy. So he will complete the EGOT and get an Oscar if he wins.
Oh, cool. So, I didn't realize that was a thing. I didn't know that it had like a...
Oh, yeah. EGOT. Yeah.
Wow.
It is definitely... I first learned about the EGOT from 30 Rock.
Oh, really?
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So thank you, 30 Rock, for that. Let's see. Next up here, CinemaBlend.com. Looks like Lego Movie's getting a sequel already. The movie's been out for like 5 days, and they've already got a sequel going. It really did look like a really cute movie, and so I was not going to be, you know, shying away from seeing it. But I think it's absolutely hilarious that the movie's been out for 5 days, and they're already willing to throw a sequel at it. So I'm now more curious to see it than ever. Let's see here.
You know, Matt is getting older when he starts calling something cute or referencing something as being cute. Well, the movie doesn't look awesome. No, guys, it looks cute.
That's right.
Are you wearing a cute top?
It is a family-oriented movie. I think I can get away with cute for family-oriented movies.
But this is not a family-oriented program. Our program.
But in describing, in being descriptive of a family-oriented movie, I think I could use family-oriented language. You know what? How about this? The movie looks fucking cute.
Yeah, but if you were wearing chains and leather... It would be. I mean, I don't know. I'm visualizing you as like a crazy hard rocking biker dude, a biker dad with leather chaps, and yeah, this shit's fucking.
Well, good,
cute.
Good. Then picture that and know that no one will fuck with me when I use the word cute.
This fucking caramel macchiato is delicious. Cute.
Indeed. All right. So let's see here. Courtesy of msnvideo.msn.com, and this was supplied by Stupid Videos. There is an anchor out in what's the name of the station, Tim? You know the station.
Yes, it's KTLA.
KTLA in LA, in Hollywood. The anchor there, he's the guy, I guess, the entertainment guy.
Yeah, what's his name?
They
don't find his name.
They don't give his name. They don't give his name.
I can find his name.
Okay. That he apparently is so loathed by Hollywood, according to Tim, that people just really don't want to be there whenever they have to go and talk to this guy. And then he goes and sticks his foot in his mouth when talking to Samuel L. Jackson. By doing this...
I like this. I tell you what, you working for Marvel, the Super Bowl commercial, did you get a lot of reaction to that Super Bowl commercial?
What Super Bowl commercial?
Oh. You know what? I've been my mistake.
You're as crazy as the people on Twitter.
Right.
I'm not Lawrence Fishburne.
That's my fault. Oh, I know that. God. That was my fault. My mistake. You know what?
We don't all look alike.
Father, you're exactly
right. We may be all black and famous.
You
but
are
we all
guilty.
Don't look alike.
I am guilty. I am guilty.
He thought you were Bob Dylan.
Right.
You're the entertainment reporter.
I know.
You're the entertainment reporter for this station.
Flog.
And you don't know the difference between me and Lawrence Fishburne.
My mistake. I apologize. Really, my big mistake. Let's talk about.
That must be a very short line for your job.
I'll say. No. person. It probably would not be hard to get another person to sit right here. Let's talk about RoboCop.
Oh, hell no.
Really? Really?
I apologize.
I'm the other guy. But I'm the other guy. The other one. What's in your wallet?
Right. Yeah. That's it. That's exactly right.
There's more than one black guy doing a commercial.
There it is. No question about that.
What's in your wallet black guy.
Okay.
He's the car black guy.
There it is.
Morgan Freeman is the other credit card black guy. You only hear his voice, though, so there. You probably won't confuse him with Lawrence Fishburne.
You're 100% right. To RoboCop,
there's a heavyweight black guy that's like putting cash down in the seats in a baseball stadium, but he's also the black guy that turns off the house, the water, and the lights when his kid tells him the house is cool. Right. I'm not that guy either.
Do we want to do a list of all the people that you're not?
And I've actually never done a McDonald's or a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial.
Fair enough.
I know that's surprising.
Right. Fair enough.
Oh, man.
To the original...
And I'm the only black guy in RoboCop that's not a criminal.
Okay.
Other than Michael K. White.
I don't know. Me, personally, I just think it's absolutely fucking fantastic. Who voluntarily incurs the wrath of Samuel L. Jackson?
And it's Sam Rubin. Sam Rubin is the anchor's name.
There you go.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, my God. It's absolutely... Yeah. So at any rate, there was that. Thought that would share that with you. That was absolutely hilarious. Since we're on RoboCop, we're gonna go back here. We've got theindependent.co.uk. All right, courtesy of Gil Pringle, RoboCop's Gary Oldman. My dog has more dignity than the Kardashians. Now, what happened was Gil Pringle went out to LA and actually met up with Gary Oldman to discuss two things with him. One, and most importantly, the fact that he is now the biggest Hollywood box office star ever. He is the highest grossing actor in the history of motion pictures. So he went down there to talk to him about that, and also to talk to him about, you know, his life and his work. And he talks about something interesting, because he was a single dad for quite some time. He's on his fourth marriage, and so his kids are pretty much grown up now. But in between his third and fourth marriages, he was a single dad for about 10 years. And so he talks about how he got really lucky with franchises like Harry Potter, which is part of the reason why he's in that highest grossing category, because he's been involved in all these big franchises. He talks about how he was lucky. He didn't go after Harry Potter. They came to him. And so he's like, okay, I'll go spend 2 months and go do a movie and then spend 10 months with my kids. And that's how he was able to do that. And so he goes after, he's happy to take the big franchise parts in order to go and be able to pay his bills and then sit back and do the stuff that he's always wanted to do. And I just think that that's really cool. And I also did not know that he was British. I know, who knew, right? Because, and they even remark on it in the article that he can effortlessly switch between British and American accents. He just jumps right back and forth. And the guy is just really cool. This is a really great article. I would definitely recommend reading it all the way through. And they do get on to the Kardashians. Shirley Temple passed away at the age of 85. She was, of course, world-famous child star. Worked with people, establishment stars, and then made stars. She actually worked with Bojangles back in the day. And she also worked with future presidents. She worked with Ronald Reagan on screen. And while she was like one of the highest paid stars in Hollywood and actually saved 20th Century Fox from bankruptcy, she was a child star. And to become more than that, she eventually did leave the movies. She didn't really make any more movies past, I want to say, 1941. And then she ended up going into politics. After an unsuccessful bid in 1967, she ran as a Republican for Congress. She ended up serving in Richard Nixon's administration as a member of the delegation to the United Nations General Assembly. And she eventually would be an ambassador to Ghana for Gerald Ford. and then Chief of Protocol. And she also did work for a while with Ronald Reagan, but they eventually parted ways there. She came back for Bush 41. She was ambassador to Czechoslovakia, and she was really, really involved in trying to make the lives of those people better. She really brought to the forefront suffering in the Third World, and totally bristled at the idea of being called a former child star. She says, "We're all former kids. You're not what you were. You are what you are now." She was just a dynamic person. And The Little Princess is going to always be my favorite Shirley Temple movie. There are three really good articles on this. I would recommend going across the board on these here. The Hollywood Reporter has a great article on her. The BBC.co.uk, from their news, entertainment, and arts section, also has a wonderful obituary on her. And then something that actually focuses on her diplomatic career was WashingtonPost.com from the national section. And all of these are from February 11th. And they are great articles, definitely worth reading as a combo, so that you can get all different sides of her life and career.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. And she was pretty young still. She was only 85, yeah.
That's a good, you know what? That's
not
a
young,
good,
but I mean, it's, you know, it's.
Hey, 85 years young is just all right with me.
Yeah.
All right. And the op-ed from the NewYorkTimes.com. This is from February 7th. And this is Woody Allen Speaks Out. I'm just going to sum up this article. Basically, he goes into great detail about how he was exonerated of this back in the 70s, back in the 90s, whenever this was, when actually everything went down. When I say exonerated, like, he was actually investigated, and the actual commission who investigated came back and said he didn't do it. Pretty much just eviscerates Mia. And unfortunately, as a byproduct of that, also kind of tears apart Dylan. Now, he makes it abundantly clear that he does not believe that Dylan is out to do this maliciously to him. He believes that she's just bought into what her mother has told her. He's got one of the kids back on his side. Then, of course, Dylan and her other brother still hate Woody Allen. Woody Allen has subsequently adopted other kids, and this was post the investigation, everything that went down, and so he was scrutinized extra closely because of all that, and still has been able to adopt other kids. I gotta say, this is why I said last week, you gotta go with innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, none of this stuff about him having gone to court came out before. None of this stuff about having been previously investigated came before. None of this stuff about adopting after all of this went down came out before. It was all just attacks and smears. And again, you still have two people whose lives are ruined because of this. And it's just incredibly sad. But I do highly, highly recommend reading this op-ed, because it's the only thing he's going to say about it. Right at the end, the parenthetical sentence at the end says, quote, "This piece will be my final word on this entire matter, and no one will be responding on my behalf to any further comments on it by any party. Enough people have been hurt. So please, please, please go check this out. NewYorkTimes.com.
I think we were all expecting him to really put his foot down and say his piece in his defense. And of course, we don't know for sure what's going on, but I think he proves a stronger side, a stronger case towards the whole issue. And that's just my opinion, personally.
Fair enough, fair enough. All right. Well, then last but not least for me, and this is going to tie in perfectly for Tim to lead off, is what the fuck is going on with Shia LaBeouf? Let's see, he goes to a conference about, and this is, of course, for Nymphomaniac, and it's a big panel thing. It's in Berlin, it's a press conference, and he shows up missing a tooth. I'm not fucking around. Missing a tooth, dressed like a homeless person, and he gets a question, and the question is, what do you think about doing a movie with so many sex scenes? And this is what he had to say.
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it is because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. Thank you very much.
Okay, your question, please.
That's it. And then he leaves. And he's not seen again. This is courtesy of Radar Online, by the way. Okay? Courtesy of the Radar staff. Both of these. He then shows up at the red carpet wearing the bag from his future art exhibit. He's got a paper sack over his head that says, "I am not famous anymore." Oh my god, dude. What the actual fuck? What the fuck, dude? Go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say because it goes perfectly into what you said, what about your article that you've got on him. So, what do you think, Tim?
I don't know what's going on. I mean, it's interesting going on Twitter, and if you go to the hashtag, oh shit, I forgot, I am a liar, or I am lying, something like that. If you go to Shia LaBeouf's Twitter account, it's pretty much what he has been posting for the past, like, 10 days, the same exact thing. But go there, and you can read everybody's kind of, they're like testimonials of when they went to his show, his exhibit, where he's sitting down at a table with his palms out, wearing a tuxedo. He's wearing a paper bag with holes cut out so he can see you or stare at you. And people have been talking about their experience. Like, I read the statement, the letter a couple weeks ago, where you can pick all these different random objects to take in there, like horrible tweets, this book that he was plagiarizing from. You can take a bottle of Jack Daniels. You have an Indiana Jones whip, an Optimus Prime toy, all this stuff. And hearing what people have to say about it is kind of weird, because everybody comments how underneath the eyes, and it's creepier because he's wearing a paper sack with his, I mean, he's looking at you and you can see his eyes, but you can see him crying. And some people actually attempted to shake his hand, give him a hug. One guy took off the sack and took a picture of him. So, I mean, it's actually him underneath there. And what I think is even more interesting, and I kind of forget that I live in West Hollywood, Los Angeles area, because this exhibit is hashtag I'm a liar, or whatever it is, I forget what it's called. It's literally like 4 blocks away from where I live. So from now until Sunday, when it closes, I have a chance to experience this very weird, unworldly experience. And I'm not too sure if I'd feel very comfortable being in the same room with him crying at me, to be honest. Yeah, I don't know if it's because I don't know how I would react to it, if it's like it would be an emotional thing for me, or if I would just get really creeped out and just would say something so awkward that might be the thing that really, like, makes him snap. And yeah, it seems like something like that would happen. Yeah, that's what I gotta say. However, it turns out that Shia LaBeouf, some time ago, a couple weeks, actually last week, said that he was retiring. That was it, because of all this plagiarism stuff and him just kind of, like, digging himself into a giant hole. He decided that he was not going to do any movies. Well, it turns out that he is a liar, because just days, seriously, days after saying that he was going to retire, he joined the all-star cast of Rock the Casbah. So he isn't retiring after all. And this flick, funny enough, also stars Bill Murray, Bruce Willis, Kate Hudson, Danny McBride. However, Bill Murray, who is the star of Rock the Casbah, had this to say about his future co-star. He says, quote, "Shia LaBeouf, I don't know. He's got a funny name. That's his problem. And cross to bear. It's like a boy named Sue. He probably got beat up a lot." End quote. Of course, if it's Bill Murray, it's more deadpan. It's a little bit quicker and a little bit wittier sounding. So just picture Bill Murray saying that. And that's what he has to say. And it'll be interesting, this movie, Rock the Casbah.
It's not that he lied. It's that he took my advice and I said he could unretire. Because now we can just ignore him and he'll go away.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Carry on.
So Lionsgate Pictures, their subsidiary company, Summit Entertainment, and these guys did Twilight. They did the most of these tween hit movies. Well, I think a number of them turned out not to be hits. However, they are in a lawsuit with Behind the Line Productions, and this production company, they made a movie called Twi Harder, And by the name of it, you know that this is yet another spoof of the Twilight franchise, of the popularity, and Lionsgate doesn't like that, despite all the other comedic feature-length spoofs of that franchise, and every other franchise, like The Hunger Games, there's even spoofs on that. So Lionsgate just really doesn't like this, and according to The Hollywood Reporter, they say that, quote, over the years, the Twilight rights holders have been fiercely protective of their intellectual property, targeting, among other things, Twilight toiletries, because if your butt hurt, why not use your own product to clean it up? A Bella Swan jacket, Robert Pattinson t-shirts, a documentary about forks. A documentary about forks, that's right. Washington music inspired by the film, and Twilight.com. This, though, marks the first time that Lionsgate Summit has filed legal claims against a film holding itself out to be a parody. To some extent, Behind the Lines Productions brought on this fight. And the article goes on. It's a very interesting article, kind of just going more in depth over this issue. It's entitled Lionsgate Goes to War Over Twi-Harder Movie, written by Eric Gardner. And then another quick quote from here. They say that, quote, besides some procedural madness, though, not much has happened until the counterclaims this week, which, in a coincidental bit of timing, happened just as Congress heard testimony over whether copyright fair use rules needed adjusting. Behind the Lines has described Twi-Harder as a film that portrayed hyper-exaggerated caricatures from the Twilight Saga movies and lampooned expressive elements in Defendants' pre-existing works through imitative reference. Lionsgate, on the other hand, says that Twi-Harder is based on the plot lines and characters of its own franchise. After its screening, Lionsgate says that it did not ally Summit's fears, but instead confirmed that its belief that the motion picture and its related promotional artwork infringed Summit's copyrights in and related to the Twilight motion pictures, and that plaintiff's use of Twi-Harder as the title of its motion picture and on merchandise was likely to confuse consumers. End all quotes. Because people are going to be so confused if they're going to watch a movie and it's totally not the actors in that said movie. So, I don't know. What do you think, Matt, that this fair use law, it's going to be... something's going to happen to it? There's going to be some kind of like change or development in it to where more studios have more control, a tighter grip on these spoofs?
No, I do not think that, and here's why. They have already ruled. This was a Supreme Court ruling. Almost positive it was federal Supreme Court. Might have been the state Supreme Court in California. Ruled that spoof and satire is protected as its own form of speech, and that's what allows people like Weird Al to go about their business. Now, he's very nice about it, and he goes and asks permission, all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, he does not have to do that. And it's the same thing. If you are going after someone directly and spoofing their material or making a satirization of their material, you are allowed to use their material in order to do so. Now, you still have to credit the initial source of the material, but you can use it and make a profit on it. And I don't see how anybody's going to be able to get around that, because eventually anybody who does try to bend that rule and control more of that stuff on their own is going to shut themselves out of future profits later on. I don't see fair use being denied on that ever.
Another article from The Hollywood Reporter entitled BECTU calls on UK Screen Association to conduct inquiry into visual effects work conditions. The BECTU stands for the Broadcasting Entertainment Cinematograph and Theatre Union, and these are the people that represent the UK-based visual effects companies, and they're saying that these people aren't safe. The working conditions for these visual effects artists are not safe. And this is interesting because I remember going to see The Abyss, the screening, and they had a panel, and they had the special effects guys there, the set people there, the actors there, and they were talking about how much hell and torment they were put through, the scuba divers, because of how cold the water was and how long they had to stay in that water tank, because the entire movie is underwater. It's the same thing with Titanic. and all that is that there. I mean, maybe not so much more now because of all of these green screen movies and all that stuff, that a lot of stunt people and visual effects people aren't really put in so much peril or so much of these crazy work conditions. But there are those that still have to do this, for stunts especially. But the BECTU recently, and quoting Hollywood Reporter, recently released a VFX, Visual Effects Working Time Charter, petitioning UK screen member companies to maintain employer standards, saying that for too many, working in the visual effects industry can be a draining experience, with long, unpredictable hours and insecure contracts. It calls on association members to support voluntary and paid overtime, statutory rights to daily and weekly rest breaks, the right to representation, and related conditions. And the article goes on, talks a little bit more about that. And they conclude with saying that, quote, "The conditions under which the visual effects artists work has been a continuous topic in Hollywood and around the world, and has been the subject of many meetings, demonstrations, and other initiatives this past year. A rally is being planned to take place Oscar Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m., on Hollywood Boulevard. A rally was also held on that day a year ago, which I remember seeing," end quote. So that is some fascinating stuff. Look it up, guys. I have a couple deaths to report as well. One being Curse of the Cat People star Ann Carter. She passed away at the age of 77. And the one and only Sid Caesar. Hilarious. This man influenced so many people. Woody Allen, Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, his best buddy Carl Reiner. If it wasn't for Sid Caesar, there would not be an Alan Brady on Dick Van Dyke Show. And the reason why there was Alan Brady is because Carl Reiner modeled Alan Brady based on his boss back in the 50s on the Your Show of Shows that they did in 53 and 54, which was a fantastic, fantastic work of comedy, especially for the 1950s. Hilarious stuff. So that Sid Caesar passed away at the age of 91. All right, so the CNC, which is Romania's film commission, originally gave Nymphomaniac Volume 2, it's no SLS cast news without Nymphomaniac news, they recently gave Nymphomaniac Volume 2 an 18XX rating, labeling it pornographic and making it unavailable for all theatrical runs. And this is throughout Romania. However, Independenta Film, which is Nymphomaniac's Romanian distributor, appealed the decision, and as a result, the film's commission had changed the rating to an 18+, which was what they rated the first Nymphomaniac, or Volume 1 of Nymphomaniac. Due to this, the president of the ratings commission was fired from his position because he gave the movie a worse rating than, I guess, what it deserved. Or because he got caught doing it, or because this just caused an uproar, and some people are just mad. And he really didn't get fired, he just got dismissed from the position. But however, he is still serving on the board. The last one is just a mentioning of a little op-ed piece from the HoustonChronicle.com. Well, I guess it's cron.com, but it's the Houston Chronicle. And the article is entitled, "New Polish Movie Casts Cold War Spy as a Hero." And this is written by Monica Skilowska. Monika Skłodowska, and it's just talking about how they said that for many Poles, Colonel Ryszard Kukliński was a traitor for passing secrets to the Americans during the Cold War, and even Solidarity leader Lech Walesa refused to honor him after he became president. This movie casts him in a more popular light, and this is many years later when people are able to look at each side during the Cold War and realize, hey, I was in the wrong. And I'm glad that they're able to accept this as a good thing, as a good movie, and accept that they cast him in the light that he should be cast. And however, there are many countries out there that I know will not accept a movie like this. In America especially, you cannot make a movie without it causing so much uproar. However, this, which at the time during the Cold War was quite political and quite controversial, it's being, you know, accepted with open arms for the most part. I mean, there are those that are still critical, but more people are accepting it. So it's very interesting. Go ahead and check it out again. It's from cron.com, and it was "New Polish Movie Casts Cold War Spy as Hero." And that's all I've got for today.
I guess it is time for Three Squares! and Masterpiece Discussion with Matt and Tim. I have no other way to figure out how to do a combo like that, because that's what this is.
Yeah.
This is a this is definitely a great big squashed up thing that we're doing here. This is basically all about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we're going to be discussing life and times of Philip Seymour Hoffman and a little bit of news about him, and then of course covering our favorite movies. Our three favorite movies.
Of his.
Yes. I'm sorry. Our three favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman films. I think we should lead off with the question that has been on people's minds is, what are they going to do about The Hunger Games? And according to ScreenCrush.com, courtesy of Jacob Hall, as of the 7th, Philip Seymour Hoffman will be digitally recreated for his final Hunger Games scene. People are not too thrilled with this idea after what they considered nightmarish digital models of Jeff Bridges and Arnold Schwarzenegger from Tron Legacy and Terminator Salvation, respectively. Although, personally, I thought that the Arnold Schwarzenegger from Terminator Salvation was fine.
I thought Jeff Bridges was fine.
Okay. Well, the point of this article is that they don't think that that's a great idea. However, they don't envy the position that Francis Lawrence is in. I mean, I don't know. What do you think that this is a fitting tribute? Do you think this is the only thing they could do? Or
I don't know. It depends. I mean, if they're going with what they were talking about right when he passed away, when they gave their initial statement, that if it's going to be like a headshot, like a shot from behind him or something, sure, yeah, whatever. But if it's like, you know, multiple scenes or multiple shots of his face and him talking and moving around and stuff, regardless of how technology in movies and special effects is today, I don't think nothing can completely recreate an actor in a non-CGI movie. Or like it's pretty much a non-CGI movie, other than like the creatures and whatnot in the foresty area and whatnot. But
sure.
You know, I think it would just, I mean, it would be a little bit obvious. So hopefully, I don't know, I just hope they do it in a more tasteful, kind of like subtle way than something like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Jeff Bridges.
And I will say this, I watched, when I watched the 50th anniversary special for Doctor Who, they did a standing shot, a pull-away shot, where they had all the doctors there, and of course, they showed the doctors in their prime. And while there are doctors, the people who have played the doctor that are still alive, there are several who either did not want to come that could have, like Christopher Eccleston, and then, of course, others that have passed away. And they did really good job of doing the standing shot, and they had everybody, and they just basically mapped the faces over body doubles. In the event that it, like you said, it's kind of a still shot thing where they can just kind of do it in a passing manner, then, yeah, I could see that that could be successful, but now, of course, all eyes are going to be on this scene for sure. All right, well then, on that note, Philip Seymour Hoffman is definitely someone who was very highly regarded and very highly respected, and yet did not necessarily respect himself. And by that I mean he never really was happy with himself. And I think that in a lot of his roles, he brought that quality to his parts. Now, I'm not saying that he was just playing himself or anything. No. I mean, he definitely was acting, but he was able to, I think, channel that quality of self-doubt and maybe a little bit of self-loathing into the roles that he is best known for. And for me, that's why I picked the roles that I picked for him. These particular movies are my favorite performances of his, not because they are necessarily better or worse than other ones, or maybe they are not as successful or as critically acclaimed necessarily, but for me, I really think that they get at the heart of the awkwardness, the self-loathing, the evil, the dark side of him that eventually manifested itself through his addiction. And while he did successfully beat it for 23 years, it did eventually come to haunt him and ultimately become his undoing. And so a lot of people cite Boogie Nights as his big breakthrough role. And yet there's also in that time frame for me was the first movie that I picked. And these are all in chronological order for me. So I'm just going to go with my early pick here. And then Tim, you take over and we'll just trade off. My first pick is The Big Lebowski. And I have used this on many different occasions because this movie is just a fantastic film. And of course, it's a Coen Brothers film. And in this movie, he plays Brandt, Big Lebowski, the true Big Lebowski's personal assistant. And the man that plays mediator between the two Lebowskis. And he is just this completely fake, disingenuous klutz, nerd, and yet, yeah, that laugh, and he's so awkward, and he just, you can tell that it's almost like he hates his job and hates his position, but he has to make the best of it, because there's got to be a light at the end of the tunnel somewhere, and yet, it's just this constant madhouse around him. Yet at the same time, he displays courtesy and respect to those around him. And yet I think it eats at him inside. And he plays that awkward role so, so well. And it's just one of the things, especially like Tim, you just said, with that laugh when Bunny's offering him the blowjob for $1,000, you know. It's just one of those parts that really, to me, showed kind of like the inner, to me, showed like a real inner window to how maybe he saw himself at that time, you know. And so that makes it in the earlier works for me, when he was really coming into his own, one of my favorite roles of his. Where would you like to go with that there, Tim?
All right, so I guess we can do kind of like a back and forth type of thing. So the first time I ever saw Philip Seymour Hoffman, I had no idea who he was, and I totally didn't think anything of him until one of Matt's movies coming up. I'm not going to spoil it, but not till a little bit later on in the mid-90s. But it was Twister. You know, that was his first movie that came out. And with these movies, he established this, like, likability about him. You know, he wasn't quite like his, like, Capote or in A Late Quartet. You know, he's not known as, like, a serious, sad actor. However, in the movie Boogie Nights, which is considered as his breakthrough role in 1997, he actually plays one of the most heartbreaking characters because he's a bittersweet guy. His name is Scotty J, and he's one of the members of Jack Horner's, the Burt Reynolds character. He's the big porn producer director. He's like a member of his like group of dudes, the misfits, the ensemble of, you know, the porn industry in California. And he has these feelings towards Dirk Diggler, which, as we all know, is played by Mark Wahlberg. And he has this, like, I was looking up, you know, just getting some ideas from different websites. And I think it was a Yahoo Movies article. And a guy described this character as self-loathing, and that he had this, a self-loathing, tearful breakdown after he attempts to kiss his main crush with Dirk Diggler, is just like a really moving piece of acting. And he's very likable in the movie, but unlike Twister, this is when you first get an idea of, you know, this guy can act. You know, I mean, he's fun, he's entertaining to look at, he has like this look to him, he has stage presence. And to me, at least, this is the first movie that really establishes a presence in whatever film that, you know, that he first started doing. Like, this is his movie that I think people really started paying attention. Boogie Nights, that's my first movie, like Boogie Nights and Twister. You know, this is where he started his likability characters, his spawning into the acting world, I'd say.
My next movie comes 6 years later, and this is definitely the one that most people in the casual world of film would recognize him from. And this is from 2004. It's the romantic comedy Along Came Polly. This, is, of course, is the one that stars Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston as the completely unlikely couple. Opposites attract. He's a quiet insurance adjuster. She is just a flamboyant free spirit. And Philip Seymour Hoffman plays the part of Sandy Lyle, who is basically a he is a former child star. And this character is the one that everybody knows him from because he plays the bagpipes and stuff in the gymnasium, and then he takes over the meeting for Ben Stiller in the penultimate scene. And the interesting thing is that there is a key scene in this movie where his character literally breaks down and says, "I am nothing. There is nothing to me." You know, he's got this documentary that's been going on the whole movie and everything. And he hired the documentary people. There was no one after him. No one cares about him. No one wants to know anything about him and his life anymore. And that's all he has, is just that fleeting bit of fame that he was desperate to hold on to. And therein again is that darkness, that self-loathing that I think he channeled into that role. And again, the overall, the role is hilarious, but it goes to show just how much darkness there really is in comedy, and how sad and embittered comedians are, and people who are genuinely funny usually are. There's a lot of darkness that generates comedy. While everyone always remembers the funniest part of the role and just the outlandishness and everything that he brings to the role, which again, also amazing and just really funny, it's that one scene where he doesn't have anything anymore. And he confides that there is nothing, there is no one. He had to try and do this just to do something to generate some interest. It's these little keys to the characters that he plays that kind of start letting you wonder how much of him did he put into his roles. And again, I'm not saying that he was just playing himself, but good actors do draw upon the darkness and the light in their life to channel energies into their roles that they play. And you have to kind of start to wonder how much of that was coming into these roles. And this was just an amazing supporting role for him, and I was definitely glad to see it. And he really, for me, is the only reason to watch this movie. I don't really think that this movie's all that great on its own, but he, however, is fantastic in this movie.
2000s was the dawning of Philip Seymour Hoffman's emotional, humanistic acting career. I mean, this is when every movie he was in was for the most part, was a really good movie. And it was all because of him. It was all because of his characters. He was like the driving force. And I just really can't think of a movie where he was not one of, if not the lead, then a significant character. And takes the movie to the next level. And this is when he really starts really kind of cooking, you know, right before he hits his stride with like being a powerhouse performer. And the role I chose as my, my number one film during this period of his career is Schenectady, New York, which that's the Charlie Kaufman movie. It's Charlie Kaufman's directorial debut. We know him for writing Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So it's a bizarre movie, but God, he just plays such a human character. And the whole thing about the character is that he just doesn't know when to quit. I've talked about this on the show before. A quick rundown of the movie just to show you how kind of just depressing and sad this character had to be. He's a theater director. He ends up getting money to produce a show in this huge warehouse, an experimental show, where the audience walks through this warehouse to watch the show. And it's a replica of bits and pieces of New York. I think it's a replica of Schenectady, New York. All these buildings and alleyways and streets, and they look up in windows and see people's lives playing out through these windows. And it's based on his life, However, things currently, significant things keep happening throughout his life, so he keeps adding to the show. So at the beginning of the movie, he starts off in his, let's say, mid to late 30s. By the end of the movie, he's in his, like, 60s, 70s. I mean, he's significantly older, and everybody else has aged, so then he's having to go back and find younger people to play the younger characters that you know, popped up in his life. So it has a great message, and he just had to come across as such a sad guy. He carries the movie by his performance. It shows you that if anybody knew that he had problems, I'm sure could have seen it in this performance and through his characterization. I mean, it just emotes sadness and depression and trying and not being able to, quitting while you're ahead, even. And this is around the time when Capote won the Oscar for, when he won the Academy Award, Best Actor Academy Award for Capote. And he was also nominated for his role in Doubt. I mean, these were all within a couple years of each other. And all these movies, you know, very human characters. He really had to transform himself for each and every single one of these movies in some way. Fantastic performances.
Well, then, that's going to bring me to my last one. And this is actually in the same era. But the reason why I chose this movie is because, for me, this shows quite possibly the darkest side, even more than some of the darkness that comes through in Capote and in those fine performances there. And that for me is 2006's Mission Impossible 3. And Philip Seymour Hoffman actually plays the bad guy in this movie. And he is by far and away the nastiest bad guy. I am fully going to admit that when I first saw that he was going to be the bad guy, I was like, are you actually kidding me? There was no way I could buy that this guy was going to be that evil. He played the arms dealer, Owen Davian. Now, the thing here is that I actually did not end up seeing this movie until shortly before we went to do Ghost Protocol. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess I better get caught up. And I went ahead and watched this movie, and I was absolutely blown away. I could not believe the level of dastardliness that with which Hoffman plays this character. Unrelenting, just pure evil, literally willing to do whatever it takes to achieve his ends, and is not afraid to use any tool in his arsenal to do so, be it murder, mayhem, intimidation, blackmail, torture, any psychological torture, all of these things. And he does it so well. You literally believe that this man, you stop seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman and you just simply see the devil. I mean, seriously, this guy was just so amazingly wonderful at being evil. He actually had me wanting to almost replace Alan Rickman as the best bad guy ever. I just cannot say enough about how amazing he was in this role. The movie, again, pretty solid movie, great action flick, you know, all the special effects and stuff that go with it. But this is one of the movies, again, he is the reason this movie is as good as it is. And without him, this movie would not have been a success. I firmly believe. And there were so many people who were like, how the hell are you going to put him in this movie? You know, this is Brandt. This is the guy who played Brandt in The Big Lebowski. You seriously expect me to believe he can play a bad guy? And yet, there and again, the darkness that he is able to bring to this character. How much of that was him? And that's why I chose these roles. That's why I chose these movies, was because I think that not only are they truly fine performances, and while, again, they might not have been as critically acclaimed as Capote, they might not be as critically acclaimed as Doubt, Schenectady, New York, these are still, nonetheless, seminal roles that show the versatility and the depth that Philip Seymour Hoffman had in his craft. And again, it just all of this is going to boil down to what a fucking shame that he's gone. And but that for me wraps up my three movies: 1998's Big Lebowski, 2004's Along Came Polly, and 2006's Mission Impossible 3.
All right, so the last part of Philip Seymour Hoffman's career, I think, is his powerhouse, his commanding performances. And the three movie, or actually the one movie that I chose to represent my three squared, is his performance as the master. He's the leader of this cult. And a play on Scientology, for those of you who are not familiar with the movie. Powerhouse performance. He was nominated for an Academy Award. Didn't get it. He deserved it. It's just, unfortunately, one of those movies that a lot of people haven't seen due to the subject matter and due to the fact that, other than the performances, the movie is kind of a letdown, but it's still, I mean, it's worth seeing for the performances themselves. I chose two other movies as well to kind of piggyback on The Master because of how, just how commanding he is in these roles, just how angry he can get, how comically angry he can get, just how he can just really take a hold of the audience, you know, captivate people just by the use of his voice. And those other two movies are Charlie Wilson's War, which he was nominated again, and Sidney Lumet's film from 2007, I believe, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And that one also has Ethan Hawke and Albert Finney, as well, the one where the two brothers are going to go rob their parents' jewelry store because they need the money, but it all kind of goes down the shitter. So, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, what makes him such a good, fantastic actor, and another reason why I decided to make these categories of likability, humanistic, emotional, sad roles, and then his powerhouse commanding performances, is because there are not many actors out there who can do all three of these roles, let alone do all three of these characteristics in a single character, even. People say Christopher Walken is an amazing actor. Christopher Walken is a fantastic actor. I love Christopher Walken, but he cannot do. At one time, he might have, Deer Hunter, possibly, but it's Christopher Walken. You know, it's always going to be Christopher Walken. Philip Seymour Hoffman can be Truman Capote. So, again, not a lot of people out there that can, you know, successfully tackle the art of acting.
Well, then, I guess that will conclude our combination three-squared discussion masterpiece on Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I really hope that you enjoyed our little bit more in-depth character study of his roles instead of just the three movies that we might have normally picked and gone over. Next week, however, we are going to do a full-fledged masterpiece discussion. We're going to be covering a Hollywood Reporter article on China clamps down on internet video industry to have a discussion on whether or not necessarily that's even possible and to the extent that it's going to be successful. With that, I think it brings us all the way up to the movies. Yes, the movies. All right, so we have four movies this week. We have The Hunt. These are all, of course, well, the first three are nominated for Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. We have The Hunt, which is, of course, the Danish drama. We have The Broken Circle Breakdown, which is from Belgium. And then finally, we have the Italian film The Great Beauty. For movies in the theater, we went with The Monuments Men, which, of course, is the 2014 war film with George Clooney and Matt Damon and Bill Murray and John Goodman, Hugh Bonneville, Kate Blanchett, and yes. So where do you want to start, sir?
Let's go with The Hunt.
All right, The Hunt. Now, this is a movie, again, this is the Danish drama film, and this is about a guy named Lucas who is falsely accused of child molestation. And what happens when people believe that he has been molested? Or, I'm sorry, that he is molesting children. This is a very dark, dark movie. It starts off simple enough. This is a guy, he's just got a life. He is living his life to the best that he can. He's kind of had a, you know, he's he went through a divorce. He's trying to rebuild a relationship with his son. He's trying to start again in life and love.
Super and nice guy, too.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very nice guy. And then, of course, it comes out that a child who is actually the daughter of Lucas's friend, Theo, wrongly accuses Lucas of, you know, basically showing his genitals off, showing his penis off or whatever. And then there's a misconstrued thing where she actually did see a penis, but it wasn't his. She just accidentally crossed the two events, and having actually had seen the penis, said it was his. All of a sudden, this just snowballs out of control. The whole town is against him. All these kids are now starting to say that, oh, he molested me or whatever. And then just as all hope is going to be lost, people are trying, people openly attacking him, people kill his dog. All of a sudden, little things start to come out that now are starting to discredit the story. And he is starting to gain his, he's finding a way out. But can he do it? I thought this was an exceptionally well-acted movie. This is what makes me so glad that they have this category, because it's so hard for American cinema moviegoers to give foreign cinema a chance. And yet, and so when you get to see these kinds of movies and you see their nominations, you really get a chance. Now, not every movie is going to be so great, but 9 times out of 10, you're going to be exposed to fantastic movies. This is one of them. For me, I thought this was a 5-star movie. I mean, it was thrilling. It was well acted, well shot. The story was just, especially with all the stuff that we've been going on with Woody Allen over the past couple of weeks, just everything really kind of came to the fore. And the ending, though, it's the ending that you just kind of, even at the very end, it still doesn't let you go. And I'm not going to spoil the ending. I will simply say that I was both surprised and not surprised with the ending of this movie. 5 stars for me. Definitely worth watching. Please give foreign films a chance.
This is a 4.5 star movie for me. Fantastic acting. The little girl especially was wonderful. I like the twist where the movie took the stance as, you know, if normally you'd watch a movie like this and the guy actually did, like, rape the poor girl, you know? And it's all about accusing him, but yet he's getting away with it, so you feel bad for him. People are forced, because you all know, I mean, because you don't know exactly what's going to happen. I love that aspect, to where it's going to be very uncomfortable for some people to watch this, because they're going to be like, oh, wait, well, I mean, with the Woody Allen thing going on, like what Matt was saying, so many of these cases are going on, you know, even right now. I mean, not just the Woody Allen case, but just so many of them that it's going to cause a lot of people to second guess the whole system, because honestly, you know, children don't always tell the truth. Very entertaining. It wasn't trying too hard to be too real and depressing. And, you know, since it's a blatant movie, it's to the point. But Matt and I both have seen way too many movies where instead of the movie being entertaining, it is just depressing. There's no entertaining aspect to it. And I'm okay. I'm fine with crying and seeing movies that are so sad and so depressing and so gut-wrenchingly torturous for the soul, but it's still entertaining. This is one of those movies. I really don't want to say too much. I think we have already said too much about it, but it's still worth watching. It's on Netflix. Gotta check it out. I give this one 4.5 out of 5.
All right, Broken Circle Breakdowns, the 2012 Belgian drama film. And this one covers a couple. I don't know, man. Did you get, like, flashbacks of Blue Valentine with this movie, like, at all?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Okay, just making sure whether it wasn't just me. This is a couple, it's a movie about a couple, takes place over the course of, was it 7 years, 8 years?
Yeah, 7 or 8. Yeah.
About 7 years or so, as they fall in love, through their passion of bluegrass music. But, so the music is really good. I was definitely really down with the music in this movie.
It's in English.
And then, of course, how they have a daughter, and how this daughter literally changes their lives. This movie for me, I think maybe because it was so reminiscent of Blue Valentine, that I felt like I had experienced this ride before. And it's well acted, and again, the music alone is worth watching this movie for, but I just really felt like, it just really felt so similar to me to Blue Valentine. And not that it's the same, it's not the same level of passion, it's not the same level of kind of split screen watching the formation of a relationship as a relationship falls apart or anything. I don't want to compare it that, it's not a copy. But it did seem to offer a, for me, less than stellar view of the course of a relationship, especially for one that is that comes together in such a unique way. And it, to me, because of that, it kind of seemed to drag. And it's not a bad movie. I think at the end of the day, for me, this movie is 3.5 stars. It's not a bad movie. Again, I would say please give this movie a shot, if nothing else, just for the music. But I really do think that... I really think that they could have done a better job overall of keeping... I guess kind of just to really kind of keep the relationship as unique as how it came together, to keep the uniqueness of the relationship in how it comes together throughout the whole movie. And I think that it gets a little bit cliched, and when it does, it causes the movie to suffer a little bit and drag somewhat. And so that is why I give it 3.5 stars. I hope that I did not just completely lose everybody there, but that's where I'm at.
No, and I think it is safe to say that what causes some... You know, so a lot of the drama in the movie is that at the beginning of the movie, you find out that their daughter has cancer. And that sets off a series of flashbacks to the relationship. And I absolutely love how the two of them got together, what brought the couple together, them building a house, their like farmhouse, and them raising their daughter. And just their story, I think, was just so beautiful. And the characters are so beautiful. And you know, another very charming girl, a young female girl, you know, young female actress in this movie playing their daughter, just absolutely charming. There's just so much about this movie that I loved, that it's a shame that it does get a little cliched. And honestly, this movie hit me so much more than Blue Valentine, only due to some situations that I've been exposed to with the loss of a child, and how that can affect certain people, and especially affects relationships. And I just kind of think that because you're just peering into selective scenes from these people's lives, it does come across as cliched, and it seems quite a little bit too melodramatic. So by the time the ending happened, you just kind of want to shoot yourself. Seriously, because this movie does something that gets me in successful, really sad, depressing movies that really kind of get me going in the tearing department. And unfortunately, this movie has a handful of these... I mean, it's like these bittersweet scenes that you just really don't want anything horrible to happen to her. And you don't want anything horrible to happen to this family. So everything that happens in the movie, their fights, even in the flashbacks, when you know everything's going to work out okay, it seriously tears you apart. Or at least it tore me apart. I love the dynamic between the leads, but just unfortunately these bittersweet moments are run over by, I say melodramatic, but it's like tragic despair and extreme sadness. And I think that the movie would have been better off if they kind of steered clear from the Greek tragedy aspect of it and stayed within the sweet... I'm not kind of second-guessing myself, because even I think maybe the flashbacks could have even been an issue, because if it was just a linear movie, you know, start to finish chronologically, there might have been more that build up to the extreme tragic sadness that comes at the end of the movie. but just it really is a really, really good movie, and just an effective movie, I'll say that. However, I give this one 4 out of 5 stars. Check it out. It's good. Just don't watch these movies back to back.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. All right, let's see here. So that's going to bring us over to The Great Beauty. And this, of course, is the Italian submission for Best Foreign Language Film. And this is about a guy. He's an older man. I want to say he's about 65. It's a 65th birthday party. It takes place in the film. And this is a guy who wrote a book. He's kind of like Harper Lee, okay? Where she wrote one book and never really wrote anything else ever again. Maybe little articles and stuff like that. Same thing with this guy here. He wrote one book, major success, and just basically just been more or less living off of his fame for that for the rest of his life. And he ends up going on a walk more and recounting his life. Not necessarily the entirety of his life, but various moments throughout his life. Life, love, and they're all tied to things and characters that he sees as he's going along his little walk here. And just kind of a general sense of, I don't know if unfulfillment's the right word, but I guess what the French would call, je ne sais quoi. But this one is definitely a good movie. I think here, where Broken Circle Breakdown tends to drag and becomes a little bit cliched, this one here really maintains the pacing a little bit better, and for me, tells a more solid story, even though there's love, there's life, there's loss, there's gain, there's happiness and sorrow. And this one, I think, really, I really love the way that this one is shot. The cinematography here is really, really cool, and of course it's Italy. I mean, you know, good God, how do you not like Italy, right? And so because of that, I think the technical elements here raise the bar a little bit. This one for me becomes a 4-star movie. There are still some minor issues with it. Nothing that I think would stop anybody from truly enjoying the movie, but it will definitely not be like the best movie you've ever seen. It's not going to be one of those fantastic, long time remembered foreign films, but it is a very, very solid effort, very technically good effort, and a decent story. So I gave this one 4 stars. What do you got there, Tim?
Fellini, he's a celebrated director, Italian director from the 60s and 70s, even up into the 80s. And this movie, and I'm bringing him up because this movie is being compared to Federico Fellini. Just the style, the movie, the tone of the movie. I just jotted down a few things that really like kind of stood out for me to compare it to, especially La Strada. Exploitation of sexuality, the idea of the most desired woman is sexual and has large breasts. There's a silly sense of humor, like with the dwarf or the drunk sexual fat woman, the ancient mysterious nun at close to the end of the movie. Also, like society's obsession of not wanting to get older. You know, those are just some like really common things that The Great Beauty shares with a number of Fellini's most classic movies, especially. The Fellini movies that have the character Marcello. He's the guy that wears the black suit and the horn-rimmed glasses. Well, at the very beginning of The Great Beauty, the lead guy, Jep, played by Tony Savio, he's wearing a black suit. And so it's definitely a tip. It's a hat tip to Fellini and 8.5. I said La Strada earlier. I meant La Dolce Vita. And I was just kind of waiting for when the movie would stop feeling like a Fellini remake and start becoming more of like a Fellini head nod or tip of the hat to him. However, opposed to Fellini's movies, which I really don't I'm not as obsessed with them as a lot of people are, but I actually understand Sorrento's, the director's characters and his direction of the characters that he produced in the movie. And Matt, I don't know if you realize this, but this is the same director who directed a movie with Sean Penn that we really liked. I'm not there yet. The one where he's trying to find the guy who murdered his father in the U.S., the Nazi who murdered his father.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah.
These two movies kind of share the same qualities. So it's about these guys that are, it's self-exploration. You know, they're trying to find themselves throughout this movie. You know, they're not social. Well, they're social in different ways, but they're more internal. You know, their feelings are expressed internally. And by the end of the movie, you know, it's not necessarily a 180, but it's more of a real life kind of character change than like an obvious, I am so sad, but then all of a sudden I'm so happy, and, you know, kind of like a Disney movie, little cliche explanation of that, I guess. Sorrentino, the director, he has such beautiful and fluid direction. Some of the cinematography was fantastic. And how this movie was, and again, I mentioned it, a lot of people have been comparing it to Fellini, especially in a structure as well as in storytelling, in characters. Like, there are so many bizarre characters in this movie, and there's also very true, you know, real-life characters, like real-life people in this movie that you can actually relate to. But you find a way to relate and take stuff from every single character, and it really has an influence on Jep, the main guy who's trying to find his way and who's wanting to try to become a guy who enjoys life and his surroundings, other than being stuck in being in a socialite party, you know, doing drugs, drinking, and sleeping with random girls mode. And it's kind of fun seeing him become more wiser, seeing him become wiser during each conversation he has with different groups of people, you know, throughout various scenes during the movie. And it's fun experiencing that. Again, the movie was shot beautifully. You understand why his character wants to be the socialite because of what he surrounds himself with. This film reminds me of the Italian and other foreign films from the 60s and 70s, even the early 80s. This totally reminded me of the French films of Jean-Jacques Brunet. He's done some fantastic movies that are very much like this. The picture itself can tell a story. And that, I mean, that's why I love this movie. And I kind of think that this will win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And I give this one 4.5 out of 5 stars, despite the little bitty issue that I had with it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got a kick out of it.
That brings us to the last movie that we have, which is The Monuments Men, the 2014 American-German war film directed by George Clooney. Written and produced by Clooney and Grant Heslov, and then, of course, stars George Clooney and Matt Damon and Bill Murray and John Goodman and Hugh Bonneville, Cate Blanchett. There's tons of people in this movie here. Now, this is based on the true story of a group of curators and art historians who went to Europe to salvage the stolen art. Just basically salvage all the stolen art that Germany, that the Nazis had taken, in an effort to, it was twofold. One, when they won the war, the Germans, you know, planning on winning the wars, they were going to, of course, build the Third Reich that was going to last 1,000 years, and of course it had to be the center and the envy of the world, not just in terms of Hitler and his grand design, but also in terms of culture. So they were going to need art to show off just exactly how cool they were. So they stole literally about one-fifth, by the end of the war, they had stolen about one-fifth of all of the art treasures known to the world at the time. And they hid them in underground bunkers. They hid them in Liechtenstein Castle, whatever it is, the one that Cinderella's castle is based off in Germany. As a matter of fact, they also had contingency plans in case they were lost, they were losing the war, were just flat out discovered, to burn it all, destroy it all, cause cave-ins and stuff like that. They were actually going to destroy that castle. And it wasn't just Germany that they were focusing on. They also focused on Italy and stuff like that. There were people who were trying to save all the art there. Of course, you had the Sistine Chapel and everything like that. But this one just pretty much focuses on Germany in and of itself. And there have been a lot of people who are... I think this is one of those movies where, given the caliber of the people involved and given the caliber of the production side and the producers directed by George Clooney and everything, and previous work, granted, I think people were expecting a lot more than the simple story that's given. It's a very simple story. It's fun. It's not overly exciting, but this is basically how they went about getting through the army. They go through basic training. They do all that kind of stuff, and then they and some of their misadventures and everything like that. It's a very, very simple movie. It's a very likable movie, but I think, given again the caliber that people involved, everyone was expecting so much more. And I think when they saw what they got, that's what kind of caused all the people to kind of step away and say, "Oh, I didn't like it as much." It's literally like 30-something% on Rotten Tomatoes. Even with the audience, it's only 53%. But for me, very simple movie. I highly encourage you to go on the Netflix and just look up the documentary on the real guys, because that's just really cool. It's really neat to just go over and really take a look at the art and the whole story behind it. It's all done very, very well on the documentary side of it. But this movie is still very entertaining. It's a very simple story, very likable, and that's all. It is not going to be special, and consequently, you can see why they pushed it back into February. So for me, this is just a simple 3-star movie. I liked it. Nothing special. Not a bad movie. Definitely wait for Redbox on this one. And I think that's it, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure. I'm glad we're not doing all 5 foreign movies.
I just can't get around to doing the other two, especially since we've got 5 more movies next week. All right, so we're going to fill in the last remaining gaps of some, like Best Actress and stuff and whatever that we just haven't gotten to see, because we covered a lot of the stuff before the Oscars, which was kind of cool. And so now that we've kind of hit all the major categories, we're just going to fill in the gaps here. So the movies that we're going to watch are going to pretty much wrap up the Oscar nominations for us. We've got August Osage County, Nebraska, and Blue Jasmine. And then we are also going to go ahead and knock out 2 more new movies, The Lego Movie, so we can finally see what all the hype is about, and RoboCop, which I'm more and more not wanting to see. But we're going to watch it anyway. And I think that's going to take care of it, yeah?
Yes, sir. I believe so.
Is it time for the spiel?
Spiel on.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at reverbnation.com, facebook.com, and myspace.com/criesofsolace. As for us, well, of course, we're still the SLS Cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @theslscast. Go on to Facebook and search the SLS Cast there and like us and all that kind of fun stuff. And of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes and now favorite us on Stitcher. Please do that. We would love to hear from you in any way, shape, or form. And I think that is all. So, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to the late, great Shirley Temple, I can say this. I stopped believing in Santa Claus at the age of 6 when my mother took me to see him in a store and he asked me for my autograph.
Cute. Take care, guy. Cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.